ॐ ज्ञानतिमरन्दस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकय चक्षुरुन्मूलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः वैराग्ययुग्भक्तिविषं प्रयत्नाय अपाय मामनभिप्समन्दम् कृपं भूया फलदूकदूकी सनातनस्थं प्रभुमाश्रयामि वंशाकौपाथरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभयेभ्य च पतितानं पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्रियाद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासदि घोर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 रामो हरे रामो Rama Rama Hare Hare. So greetings from greetings from Visant Falls, Stuyvesant Falls. I just came back from that very nice conference of young scholars, not so young. Jayadvaita Swami was there, Pradyumna, Dr. Satyanarayan, who, when I was teaching the Bhakti Sandarbha, he's the one who translated it. Really wonderful exchange and camaraderie and conference. And yesterday I went up to a yoga studio, which I've been going to for 5 or 6 years. And when I went up to the studio this time, I saw they had Gaudiya Thai deities. And I see how the influence of spiritual life works. You know, spiritual talks on Shastra, it plants like a seed. And, you know, seeds sprout and people sprout to seriousness in spiritual life. And I'm seeing that all over, and it's very, we want to have some kind of installation type ceremony for those deities, and people want to know how to worship, and then people, it's just nice. It's I'm trying to find out where I am. Just give me a second. It takes me the time, but I should do this beforehand. I'm very sorry. Okay, reading from okay, 1 second, I'll get there. Verse 38 in chapter 1, Swapna Nidra Jnana Lambana Va, or the mind becomes steady when it has the knowledge of sleep and of dreams as its support, as you remember in this particular section. It's listing the different types of meditation. Va means or. You can, or it is different objects. The idea is you fix your mind on one object, you're neglecting all the so many impulses, unlimited impulses. Even try to be silent for a second. How many thoughts come? Even when I'm speaking now, what's the level of meditation? One of the lectures, when Dr. Satyanarayan spoke, I thought it was kind of practical, he was starting for the modern age, he really emphasized meditation on whatever you're doing. You know, you know, if you're cooking, then meditate on cooking. And if you're cooking for Krishna, then you're meditating on making it nice. this habit in the, this multitasking habit in the modern world, not only multitasking, but the mind in just so many different channels, basically, and switching from one channel to another and never becoming steady. One of the purposes of meditation itself is if you can steady the mind in one place with some type of practice, it can carry over to other places. But, you know, that's one of the things with chanting japa, that the mind is becoming fixed. We have to, I mean, he made a very, very interesting point, too. He said the Shastra was spoken thousands of years ago when there were no cell phones, when there was no television, when there was no email. And even if you're not using them, all these things, they're in the air. How are they being communicated? So this world is to produce in us unlimited desires. The Shastras were spoken at a time where people were relatively simple. I saw that when I was running the school in Vrindavan. Had these children from Nepal, and you can see they were so much more simple because, you know, they would have to walk to get water and live in a simple way. It really has a profound effect on the mind. So the modern civilization produces so many desires. So it's so important to be a little bit mindful to, you know, at least when you're chanting japa, to really try. When you're cooking, focus on cooking. To really be in that mood, to somehow simplify ourselves, to focus on one thing. So all this other static interference and all this thing can be kind of controlled. Of course, it was describing that by this, then one can, this practice, one can remove the obstacles to yoga. But this practice of fixing the mind on one object in order to eliminate all other distractions in yoga, that's practice. And obviously, as it's a psychosomatic, psychological process that's being mentioned, how the mind works is applicable to whatever path of spirituality you're on. By cultivating an attitude of friendship, compassion, joy, and equanimity towards situations of happiness, distress, virtue, and vice, lucidity arises in the mind. We discussed that. That's not an optional one. That's basically showing you how when you, that's not optional, how when you live in the world, and living in the world means relating in the world, it means relating with different people in the world. We have to have some restraint in terms of how we deal in the proper way. And we mentioned this many, many times, that the mind, the pure state of the mind is called sattva, and it can reflect the soul so that one can see one's true nature. Knowledge, philosophy, self-realization, basically all processes of self-development are shooting for one thing, to see the true nature of things. True nature of things. We should see the true nature of ourselves. And I just give one example. As soon as the mind goes from its pure nature of a sort, sattva, becomes distorted, the image of the self becomes distorted, and the first thing that becomes distorted is the eternality of our nature. So once we come to passion and ignorance, we will be in duality and fear. So in our relationships with others, the lower modes that distort the pure nature of the mind in terms of envy, aggression, and intolerance are constantly pushing the mind to lower modes of nature. are constantly pushing the mind to lower modes of nature, So to avoid that, you know, when there's superior people, material or spiritually, we have to consciously be their well-wisher. When there are people that are below us, we have to consciously be compassionate. And when there are people that are even impious, we have to be tolerant. And then all these other things were mentioned, the stability of the mind, you know, because advanced yoga, really, the mind and the breath are so connected that, you know, the proper breathing is important. These things can be used in any practice. And then there was that meditation on sense objects. You know, you meditate on the nose and you come into the subtle sense objects and you experience very beautiful things. It gives you faith. All these things were mentioned, and then we came to the point that the mind becomes steady when one who is free from desire as its object. And this is so key, especially to the bhakti process, that you have to pray to Guru, you have to meditate on Vaishnav and saints, and it has an effect on you because a person is his qualities. And when you meditate on a person who has good qualities and appreciate them, it creates an attraction to those qualities. So if the person is honest, you develop an attraction for honesty, you become honest. If the person is selfless, you develop an attraction for selflessness, and you become selfless. We should have pictures of saints, and we should pray and worship them. And whatever tradition you have, worship the saints, meditate on the saints, prayers to the saints. One practice, Sankhya Purva Kanama Gana Natibi, the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, the great saints, they were bowing down in scheduled measurement. What does that mean? They would chant a prayer to a saint in their tradition. And then they would pay their prostrated obeisances. And then they would chant another prayer to another saint, and they would pay their prostrated obeisances. And then by physically offering yourselves and mentally offering yourselves and saying the words, you would develop humility, but also the qualities of those saints you would be meditating on, and they would come to you. This was a practice. I know people in Vrindavan during Kartik meditations that do this type of practice. They, you know, what to speak, I know there's one person, Radha Kund, he bows down to everyone he sees and smiles. It's so blissful. But you can do it yourself, actually say prayer. When you say prayer to Guru, bow down. Mind, body, and words. It's very, very powerful. So we should do this. And we should understand that the people that we want to worship are and meditate on are those who are free from personal desire. In the Bhagavad Gita, there's all these questions Krishna asks, you know, how do you recognize such a person? First quality is the person's always selfless. He's free from personal desire. And when I think of my guru, Srila Prabhupada, that's exactly what I think of. I think that he's free from personal desire. It's so easy to be co-opted. Therefore, what did Lord Chaitanya pray? Nadanam, najanam, nasundarim, kabitam, va, jagadisha, kamaye. Nadanam, I don't want wealth. Najanam, I don't want followers. Nadanam, najanam, nasundarim, I don't want beautiful mate, followers. I don't want. That's how you become fixed. It's so hard when you're in the, you know, because one of the obstacles of bhakti is bhakti itself. Because if you're in a spiritual society, you develop bhakti, then you'll get followers and you'll get wealth and you'll get so many things. and they can agitate your taste for those things that may be latent within the heart. The first thing to do is meditate on people who are free from desires. Now it says, or the mind can be steady when it has the knowledge of sleep and dreams as its support. Now, you know, again, these are sutras, so they're kind of codified. And therefore, I mean, even Vyas is not really, it doesn't really say what really this means. So you can imagine someone trying to understand these sutras without the commentators. The mind becomes steady when it has knowledge of sleep and of dreams as its support. I'll read from the commentary, and you'll see how the commentators, they look in different ways. What does this mean? And they try to make sense out of it. What is this meditation? So it says, Vyas has little to say about this curious verse. This is Professor Bryan's comment. Except to state, without further clarification, that yogi's mind can take the form of objects of sleep and dream. Now, this will be explained, because really, basically, what happens is the mind takes the form of whatever it meditates on. And some of the commentators are going to mention that, they're going to look at it this way. One way is deep sleep is kind of like yoga. It's very peaceful, isn't it? Yoga, chitta, vritti, nirodha. The vritti is the fluctuations of the mind are destroyed. Well, when you have deep sleep, that's kind of yoga, but it's not yoga because it's kind of caused by ignorance. But still, there's some type of remembrance of that state. I tell you, you know, it's so nice when you have a sleep where you don't dream, you know, and you just kind of like wake up practically after not dreaming, and you're so refreshed in that state. It says yogis can kind of remember that state and kind of meditate on that state, but meditate on it from a platform of goodness rather than ignorance. But you can kind of get the idea. They're just recommending different things you can meditate on. So some yogis would kind of meditate on that deep sleep where the vrittis were, and then they would try to kind of recreate it in a waking state where there's no fluctuations of the mind. Again, a lot of these things are realizations of advanced yogis, and if you're not there to discuss them, you know, you get a basic idea, but not much more. But now this Vichaspati Mishra is a bit more specific about this. He says, when the yogi reaches the point, it means this is when the yogi reaches the point that he or she dreams of Ishvara. He wakes full of joy. So what happens is when one is chanting, you know, and meditating on God, Ishvara, by chanting Om. And as I think even Satchananda Swami told me, he was in Barsana doing a japa retreat by himself, and he saw that there was this one yogi came, and he was not interested in anything in the world. He was a yogi, but he was a devotee, but it was Jnana Mishra Bhakti. He was first detaching himself from the world so that he could fully put his mind on God. But he wouldn't talk. He wouldn't be interested in anything. See, so what happens is what is a dream? Is a dream is when the external senses are inactive. So the external dream is the external senses are active, but the samskara imprints on the mind are active. In other words, you shut the external senses, but you're dreaming. So the external sense is not there, but the imprints that were made on the mind by your experiences, they're active. That's in contrast to the deep sleep, when both the senses and the samskaras imprints are kind of quelled. So what happens is, if one is meditating on God during the day very, very intensely, then this type of yogi that becomes absorbed to such a level, then he'll dream of God. He'll dream of God. He'll dream of the mantra. And then when he wakes, you can awake in different modes. He'll wake in this very enlivened mode. So I guess this is what's here. When it mind becomes steady, when the knowledge of sleep and of dreams. So both the sleep is the knowledge of sleep is when the imprints are just quelled as a peaceful state, or there are or you have remembrance of devotional imprints. But it's very amazing here what this Vishchaspati Mishra says. This is what he identifies Ishvara as. He said Ishvara here is described in the Puranas, appearing like the moon in a secluded spot in a lonely forest, enrapturing the mind with his beauty, with limbs as soft as the lotus stem and a form like shining moonstone, draped with sweet-smelling garlands of malati and malika flowers. Then awake, the yogi remembers this form, and absorbed in this vision, the mind becomes steady in meditation on Ishvara. This Vichaspati Mishra of the commentators is the most bhakti and devotional. But another commentator, it's interesting, he looks at it a different way. When you're deep sleep, the chitta is free from all thoughts. So it's a type of yoga, a cessation of all thoughts. So meditating on this when you're awake. So there are different things like that. Or you can look at the world as a dream. In other words, look at the world as temporary and become detached. So it's a curious, the verse allows different interpretations. And finally in this section he says, or steadiness of the mind is attained from meditation upon something of one's inclination. So this whole series of verses were beginning with Ishvara Pranidhan, which was a very strongly recommended process of worshiping for God because of and chanting Om because of invoking God's grace, which makes this process much easier. So Patanjali wraps up this series of verses of describing different optional that ultimately, he says, the mind may meditate on whatever one desires, according to one's inclination, whether it's external or internal. So he's not really concerning in particular with a particular method, but the real that this is the principle, a meditation on a particular thing. And once the meditation becomes steady in any one area, then the steadiness can be transformed to other areas. Basically the process of meditation, it's you're really cultivating sattva. And then when these qualities of insight and lucidity are manifest, then they'll pervade all your life. So that pervade all your life. And that's one of the really important things. If you really, you talk psychology of the transformation of the mind, we should have a very, very steady practice where we really meditate on the, you know, the sound vibration with meaning and with affection. One second, I want to get your book. I want to read something. So that ends a natural section in the Yoga Sutras. It seems that I'm going a little quicker. I'd like to read something about a meditator. And his name was Vamanadas. He was actually a German man who just had this spiritual calling in the 1940s, and he went to India and he met a disciple of Bhakti Siddhanta, who is a German named Sadananda Das, Prabhupada's godbrother. And he tells his story in a book called Journey to Unknown India. It's one of the best stories about India. So I'm going to just read something about his meditation, because he met this person. And I think we'll find it interesting. A 100 times and more, I sat opposite tree in meditation. At those times, I completely forgot my surroundings. I was always filled with the deepest emotion and reverence. When I opened my eyes and saw the uplifted expressions of the old man, silent and completely abandoned to the spiritual sun. Next time I came to meditation with a straw mat of kusha grass and the skin of a deer and a cloth under my arm. This is just a young German man. He goes to India. I seated myself without any cramps now, relaxed and comfortable. Now and then people came to the room and left again. The servant brought Sri's midday meal on a silver tray and a silver bowls. This was the only meal the old man ate each day. I was surprised that all these activities did not disturb me in the least. The deepest gratitude towards Sri welled in me. Thus far, I had only a vague idea of what it meant to concentrate and meditate. And I still had a long way to go, but it began to dawn on me how meditation could develop. Time after time, I tried to concentrate during meditation, and often I saw majestic visions. But I had a secret feeling that this phase was only a temptation, dangerous because it made me proud and conceited. This pride and the inner rubbish as well, all untest, all spiritual uncleanliness, must first be carefully cleared away. One must work towards tranquility as towards the shore of an ocean of an unknown sea. And there on that shore, one must wait until the divine world, if it so chooses, receives one. When I rose from the floor after my attempt at meditation, my limbs usually ached for a long while. Yet I was marvelously refreshed, and the material world shone about me with a deeper radiance than before. It was not enough to meditate temporarily, or at a certain time of day, Sri often impressed upon me this fact. One must live in this spiritual atmosphere 24 hours a day, he said. So this is before he came directly to bhakti. He met this guru. And he gave him the meditational path. It would be several painful years before I could comprehend the four steps of meditation. The first step of meditation, to sit and to breathe, are only preparatory, just as bathing and clean clothing are but outer preparations. With practice, one is able to sit upright with crossed legs for several hours. The body does not interfere any longer. Even in pictures of recently discovered ancient culture in the Indus Valley, people are seen sitting and meditating in the same position the Indian yogis use today. The art of regulating one's breathing has been developed in India over thousands of years. When the breathing becomes calmer, the wandering spirit also becomes calm, for there exists a reciprocity between the current of breathing and the human spirit. But Indian scriptures point out that one cannot approach God simply by controlling one's breath. Breathing exercises are only an aid. What is usually called yoga in Europe is the so-called Hatha yoga. Many people assert that by this method, one can preserve youth and health for an abnormally long time and acquire magic powers. The answer the great Buddha gave a yogi is well known. The latter boasted that after 20 years of severe practice, he had learned to walk on the water. "What is the use of that?" said Buddha. "For copper coin, the ferryman will row you over the river." "Do not waste time by practicing Hatha Yoga," said my teacher Sri once. "You have already done that in a former existence on earth. Unknown powers can come to lift within you, become a temptation, and hinder you on the path." So you can get, this is known, I mean, it's a fact, we're going to discuss this later in the Yoga Sutras, that if you perfect any form of yoga, you get a mystic power. So he says this can be alluring. So many years, the utterance of the mantra, on the contrary, lets in the important things. If one looks up in a Sanskrit dictionary, one will find the following attempts at translation. The mantra, Vedic hymn, holy prayer, formula for magic, secret, charm, lines of a prayer to divinity, etc. But all these are only superficial meanings. Many years after my first meeting with Sri, I asked another Indian guru, "What is a mantra?" The surprisingly simple answer, "A mantra is something that creates loving devotion to God." The Indian seeker of the truth, whether he chooses the path of action, wisdom, or loving devotion, is convinced that the mantra he utters and the divinity he thereby calls upon are perfectly identical. Hence, the reverence for the mantra, the importance of its being correctly spoken, and the danger of its being misused for selfish purposes. Hindus have a greater respect for the spoken word than do people in the West. Not only every word in a mantra, but practically every sound and every word in the language is called akshara in Sanskrit, which means the indestructible. Akshara is also a name for God. A true mantra should be sung, not spoken. Indian scriptures called Brahma the creator, the first singer. Our world is said to have sprung from the mantra he sang. The Indian initiate tries to awaken the divine sound with his entire soul, for it is the mantra of which all earthly sounds are only a shadow. Last paragraph. In the West, these ideas are probably utterly foreign, and yes, there are traces of similar teaching. Time and time again, while in India, I marveled at the prologue of John the Evangelist. In the beginning, there was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was God. Through this, all things came to be. Anyway, something. I'm kind of finished for today. Does anyone have any questions? Anyone like to say hello? Can someone just even say something so I know that I didn't get
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Thank you, Gail. Okay. Any questions?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it's Karunika calling.
Karunika, I just got pictures, by the way, from the wedding. Haley's.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Go ahead. Thank you.
I'm thinking about a practice that I see practically in my own life. We're talking about how the mind needs to be meditating upon one particular thing, and you're using the example of, say, cooking. And I know when I do my own, when I am cooking, I concentrate a lot, but I find it much easier to concentrate on my cooking when I'm hearing at the same time.
Yeah, well,
so
I think
wondering
there's,
if there's a connection there between
those. There is
systems.
A unity there, because when you're cooking, and cooking, I'm sure, means for the deities, for Krishna, for Guru, for the Vaishnavas. When you're cooking, the thought is for God. So it's a meditation, actually, on God. Just like when Radharani is cooking for Krishna, she's thinking of Krishna. When Mother Yasoda is cooking for Krishna, she's thinking of Krishna. But while she's cooking for Krishna, she's singing Yasomati Nandana Brajabara Nagara Gokula Ranjana Kana Gopi Parana Dana Madana Manahara Kaliya Dhamma Davidana. So, you know, it's unified on that kind of platform, you know. So,
and simultaneously, I find that when I'm hearing, I hear better when I'm doing sewing, for instance, something practical, because it stills my material external senses, and then I can hear better.
Well, you know, it's still simple. It's sewing and hearing, and you're sewing for the deities and hearing. So, you know, I guess your point is, you know, you were saying just think of cooking. It means to steady the mind and fix the mind. So there's two things instead of 100, you know? And it's basically one thing, because ultimately the sewing is for Krishna and the hearing is for Krishna. And, you know, I think really that's why that last verse was there, whatever your inclination is, then meditate on it. And I guess the idea was, it's not a hard and fast rule. There's a basic conception, and the conception is there's a million distractions coming and distorting our mind and causing duality and fear. What are we going to do about it? Well, we have to meditate. So if you're sewing and hearing, to me that's meditating. You know, the mind becomes fixed on basically one thing, which is service to God, or a little variety there. Or, you know, and the same thing with, you know, cooking and hearing. You know, it's just like when I'm chanting, you know, I may have a thought. You know, really, you know, you want to focus on the mantra. So if the thought is about Krishna, the thought is about God, the thought is about some devotional principle, then my standard is, should I think of that or just pull my name back to the mantra? My standard is if what I'm thinking about enhances my meditation. So, you know, if sewing enhances the meditation on the mantra, then fine, you know. Or if hearing enhances the meditation on cooking for Krishna instead of mindlessly cooking and just thinking about so many things, you know, your problems, and everything else that can come in the mind, your attachments, your problems, your whatever it is, then I think it's just the same principle. Yeah.
Can I make a comment?
Okay, thank you, Maharaj.
Yes. Rasika, yes, please.
Yeah, this was a big issue in 1975.
Yeah.
Because right from the beginning, I was always giving, you know, sewing or making a garland or something during class. And it became such a habit that I felt the same way that, who was it that just spoke?
Karunika.
Karunika, I felt the same way that I could hear better when I was sewing.
Yeah.
So in Vrindavan, Prabhupada was giving a lecture and we were doing something. I think I was making ghee wicks or something.
Yeah.
And he said to stop it. And of course
yeah.
I was a little bit shocked.
Yeah.
And but what I realized is, I mean, I've really become habituated to do something. And but it's what I'm finding more and more as you talk about this over
yeah.
the last weeks.
Yeah.
The more I don't do that, whether it's cooking, if it's the only time you have to hear, better to do it.
Yeah.
But it's really a different experience to really focus on just hearing. Like just now during this class, I did three things.
Yeah.
You know, that I didn't get done during the day. And I felt like I heard perfectly fine, but I realized, no, you know, it would have been better to really let it go in because it goes in a different way when you're not doing something else.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I'm sure that's what Prabhupada meant. He did not want us to do sewing for the deities, making ghee wicks, even though it was Krishna's service.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
When it came to hearing.
Yeah.
So at the same time, I think it's, I agree with what you said, that if better to do two things than 10 things. better that it's, you know, service
yeah.
to Krishna, like hearing or sewing for the deities.
Yeah.
But he was trying to impress upon us about this point.
Well, I think also, you know, as Prabhupada was the Acharya teaching, he understood that people had no taste for hearing.
Yeah.
So they'd like to do anything else but hear.
Yeah.
You know, so let me get ghee wicks, let me get,
yeah.
you know.
And
but an individual thing, maybe, yeah. you know, a person is really wanting to hear and he, you know, he does something that best enhances his hearing. But as a general principle, here you are giving class, right?
Uh-huh.
And not only that, the principle that it's your guru and who that guru is, Prabhupada sitting before you. And you know that you can't offer your consciousness to him.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, chanting is offering your consciousness to the holy name. So you can't offer your consciousness to him. And in other words, you're not serving him. So I see this too. I remember one time, you know, especially about 10 years ago, I mean it's probably like that now, but I haven't been around that much, that you know, you go to the temples and everyone's breaking string beans.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, one person would start in the back and everyone would gravitate towards them. They'd want to break the string beans. you know what I'm saying? And what I understood is people really didn't want to hear, and it wasn't very inspiring for me to give class, you know?
Right.
But then there'd be another person that's just sitting straight right up in front,
uh-huh.
you know,
yeah.
just wanting to hear. So I could see how Prabhupada would get very, very discouraged and also want to teach. Respect for Guru and respect for the Bhagavatam.
Right.
By the way, Pradyumna told me, I told him that you're on my Sangha, and he said, please offer my humble respects to Rasigya.
Oh, thank you, Maharaj.
Yeah, and...
friend.
but yeah, yeah. I have something you used to cook for him, or he used to go over.
Yeah, I was working at the art gallery in
yeah.
the town, Upper East Side, and I had a kitchen yeah. down in the basement, so I was cooking for Malati, Preetu and Malati and Pradyumna.
yeah, and Pradyumna, you know, also when Pradyumna said, what is the Bhagavatam, why is there the Vyasasan? You know, because Krishna speaks through the Bhagavatam. He speaks through the Bhagavatam. So the seed is for the Bhagavatam, and the person is manifesting the Bhagavatam.
Yeah.
But it's Krishna speaking through the Bhagavatam, through the mouth of a particular person. So it's such a sacred thing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That the yeah. proper attention and respect has to be, you know, offered. And, you know, I can see Prabhupada, but in an individual thing, I think people will make individual choices where sometimes they may have to do three things,
yeah.
and it's either not hearing at all and doing the three things or trying
right.
to do them at the same,
yeah.
but in the same sense, the kind of sincerity that people have,
yeah.
you know, when they actually can hear,
yeah.
and they're looking for anything else to do in class, and that's not bhakti.
Yeah. And the thing is, I understand that because I have that situation myself many times.
Yeah.
But I do, what I really wanted to say is that it's a really good practice to try it once in a while.
Very good, yes.
That's all.
No. It's not once in a while. That should be the standard.
It should be the standard, right.
That should be the standard.
But, yeah.
That's
and it's
boxing.
Really hard for people that are used to doing it that way, though.
Yeah.
What I mean. And so it's, if you're that type of person, really
because
make
why
it
is
endeavor.
Someone why is someone attending the class and breaking the beans?
Right.
The reason, you know, one person has to do it, but why everyone wants to do it?
Yeah, right.
Because they, you know, Prabhupada said you should go to class, so they go into class so that they can. But their faith is in the rule of going to the class and not in Krishna.
Right.
Where bhakti, it is your faith is in the activity.
Right.
You know, the benefit is the hearing is one of the devotional principles. So let me hear, not let me be there,
yeah.
You know, and get credit for going to the class, but let me engage now.
Wow.
And that's what I'm getting also out of the Yoga Sutras is that kind of type of how important it is to meditate. I also had another realization today. I was in Gauravani is here,
uh-huh.
And he went to he went to the that institute, the Kripalu, which is
uh-huh.
right near here. It's
uh-huh.
a great opulence living here because you're right near that. It's 35 minutes away. And then some people are going for the kirtan, and they asked me to, you know, if you want to go to the kirtan. I had to think. And what I thought is I really, you know, how is that trip going to affect my mind, my regulation, and my mode, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm so used to following my impulses, even in the name of devotion. Yeah, I want to go there because it's exciting. I'll meet people, you know. But how does it affect your mode? But anyway, the real thing is this kind of meditation. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah. Please offer my obeisances to Gauravani. He's my godson.
Oh, okay. I'll tell
him.
Okay.
Thank you, Maharaj. Okay. That was a wonderful
Thank
class.
You. Anyone else like to say hello? Someone's trying to unplug here. Anyone else? Okay, thank you all. Bunch of help with the discharge of the senior David. I'll get it on top of the